Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I am joined once again by Vida Ayala. We are talking all about the TV miniseries, Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which adapts some stories from that particular collection, but also some that were not in that collection. They just decided to stick with the name. But Vida, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing okay. A little under the weather, but other than that, super excited to talk about more Stephen King stuff, as always.
Yeah, so before we dive into doing this episode by episode, have you read the Nightmares and Dreamscapes collection?
I have, but I read it a long time ago. There's a few that I've read more than, like, few stories that I've read more than once, but like a full read through, I think, not since like 04, maybe? Yeah, because it came out in 93, right? Something like that. So yeah. I think Crouch End is the story that I return to multiple times, and the end of the whole mess. But I will be completely honest. We'll probably get into this later, but the fifth quarter, I totally, like, I remember reading it, and then I remember going, I'm good. So that one probably is the least oft-read story of the collection. But I do, as I'm sure you have multiple times now, I do go and reread stuff, even if I wasn't sure about it the first time.
I haven't had a chance to reread too many of the stories just yet because a lot of what I'm reading for the first time. And that's not to say I hadn't read some Stephen King stuff before starting this podcast, but I want to say it was only like five or six of his books that I had read before deciding to do this maniacal weekly podcast.
That's fair. That's 100% fair. And I have to say, like, I'm a really big fan of his short stories over his novels. I have many of his novels, and I enjoy many of his novels. But I think that when his editors are like, short and sweet, Stephen, like, he really produces his best work.
Yeah, that's funny because I haven't enjoyed the collections quite as much as I was hoping. And maybe that's because I'm reading them as collections and it feels very disjointed when you're jumping from one story to the next. But, you know, something like Different Seasons, I really enjoyed because there was a certain level of humanity to all four of those stories. And even if I didn't like one as much as the other three, it felt cohesive in a way.
That's definitely themed for sure. I think that definitely has that over just a random short story collection. And those were novellas, right? Like, those were nice, lengthy. I think that's the sweet spot for Stephen, either 10 pages or like 100. Like, but like, you know, I know you did an episode on the book, so I won't get into it too much. But, you know, for Nightmares and Dreamscapes, I've read Crouch End probably five or six times as a story, and I really liked it. And I've read, this is out of Everything's Eventual, but I read The Road Virus Heads North and multiple times, and I'm really, really into it. I tend to be a short story person. I love novels and longer form stuff, of course, but, like, I really love short story prose. And so for me, I tend to jump around when I'm reading short story collections. I don't read them straight through. Like, so I'm like, oh, I'll read one this week and one next week. So for me, I have a slightly different experience, but I definitely understand it because sometimes, you know, you'll read a really good one and then the next one you're like, you did this for money. You did this for money, which, fair enough. No shade, brother.
Or like, there's one of the collections, I always forget which it is, but there's just like a story about Owen's baseball team.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, why is this not just included, like, at the back end of On Writing or Dance Macabre or something else that is nonfiction instead of throwing this random baseball story in?
Holy smokes. Yeah, that is real weird. Real, real weird. I think, like, this is applies to anthology TV shows in general, as well as short story collections. But I think that, like, you're definitely right to feel like there should be some sort of progression or like a feeling of a theme rising and ebbing for a collection. Like, I feel that way because, you know, we binge stuff now. We don't just watch stuff week to week, usually, unless we're absolutely forced to. But I watched these in three nights.
I think I did the same. It was a two or three night thing because there's only eight of them. So you're like, all right, you know what? I did do it in three nights because it was three discs. So I was like, one a night.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, okay, I wish even within these stories that they were rearranged in a way that made you feel like you were taking an overall journey. But, you know, we'll get into the individual stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, so why don't we go ahead and start off with the first episode, which was Battleground. I thought this was a very interesting one to start off with because there's no dialogue.
Yes, I thought that was so cool. I remember I saw the first three of these when they were airing, like just on TV a long time ago. And I remember really liking this one. Going back, I still like it. I think it holds up. There are a few things that have tried to play with this mechanic to varying degrees of success. And I think that this one actually uses it well. I mean, when you have William Hurt as your main actor, he can just act in any situation, so it's fine. But it's really interesting to have a story with no dialogue. I feel like you could have done the opposite and go heavy dialogue, right? Like voiceover stuff and like, you know, like all of this background. And they were like, nah, make it clean.
He also could have talked to himself a lot in this kind of story where he's like yes. running through his plan or something like that. But instead, they opt to show you, not tell you. And voiceover dialogue has been a little hit or miss for me with Stephen King adaptations. It works really well in something like Shawshank, for instance. But in the 2004 Salem's Lot, not so much.
That was a Rob Lowe one, right?
Yes.
I feel like here the silence fits the character really well.
Right.
You have this guy who is an assassin who has just gone and murdered a toy maker, which is pretty gnarly. And he's just, his whole life is very solitary and very like clean in almost like a creepy IKEA way. His apartment definitely is.
Yeah. He seems very OCD about cleanliness.
Yeah, he feels like someone that wants things in their place and doesn't have any use for people. And so to have him not even talk to himself is really, I think that's a really smart move. I thought that was really, really cool. I did think that they were pushing it a little when like he would get hurt and he wouldn't like curse, because that's not true. All right, right now.
Yeah.
You get jumping ahead a little bit, but you get shot by like, you know, a little tiny rocket and you're going to let out some expletives. All right. Like just saying.
Yeah. And instead they used the music to build the tension throughout this episode, which I thought was really well done. And I don't know if you watched any of the bonus content, but I did watch one of the segments on this. And basically, in order to animate the soldiers, they had real people dressed up with like green all over their faces. And I think they said they used a blue screen because obviously you can't really use a green screen when everyone's green. So they had to improvise that a little bit. But you could tell that they definitely had more lifelike movements to them, even though they still had that plasticky look. So I thought that turned out really well because then they just basically took that stuff from the blue screen and minimized it down to the correct scale for those kind of figures.
That's really awesome. I might go back and watch a lot of the bonus stuff. I noticed that there was a lot of it, but I was kind of trying to get through the main bulk of it. One thing too with that I thought was really cool was they do have these lifelike movements, but they'll freeze, like not just randomly, like it looks almost like they are moving like, I don't know if anyone out there had those toy, like just regular plastic toy soldiers that were just molded plastic that you would, you know, bop around. But they came in a variety of positions, and each of the soldiers in the episode would get into those positions as they were moving, as if that was kind of all that they could do. Like, yes, they like drove and they moved. But like, I thought that they really did a lot of good body work to kind of call back to those very simple toys, right? Like, you know, we're supposed to believe that these little toy soldiers have like machines or something, or they're animated somehow, right? But they still feel very basic, which is so creepy to me. Like, to me, there's the, you know, it's supposed to be a molded piece of plastic. We have hundreds of thousands of pieces of molded plastic in our lives. What if they all came to life? That's so creepy.
I would have a lot of Funkos attacking me.
Yeah, I'm staring at a bunch of like tiny vinyl toys right now on my desk. I'm like, please, if you come to life, don't hate me. I'm not an assassin who murdered the creator of any of these. So like, I got that going for me.
I think we're okay.
Yeah. But that's it's a pretty simple story and it takes place over a very short amount of time, right? But
yeah.
It's about an assassin who kills, right? He kills the toy maker, the head of this toy company. And then he gets a package, which is a big box of those toy soldiers and some of their accessories, like three helicopters and I don't know, like some sort of cannon and like all this other stuff in a special surprise.
Yeah.
Which I forgot about.
The only thing that confused me a little about this story was it was like he was checking into a hotel, because it almost looked like he walked up to the front desk and was like checking in. But then I was like, this is definitely an apartment, not a hotel, because the elevator opens like right to the doors, which I mean,
that's so weird to me. I do not like that, by the way. He's clearly rich.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've been in some newer kind of like, you know, gentrifying buildings like that, where you have a lobby person, and if they don't know you, you have to like check in with them. And if they do know you, they will hold packages and stuff for you.
Got it.
And take in any like you get regular mail in your mailbox, but they take in any packages and stuff. So I assume that's what that was. But I had the same thought. I was like,
because she brought the package up after that.
Yeah,
she didn't hand it to him.
Also, that weird lap pool in the middle of his apartment.
Yeah.
It's like, I would believe this is a fancy hotel over a fancy apartment. Also, it's cool, but I feel like an assassin with just like a big water feature in the middle of their apartment and only one way in and out is so weird. But that is all post watching it. Definitely while I was watching it, I was just like, run from these little toys. Like, they're so scary. But you kind of like are rooting for the toys too, because he's such a son of a bitch.
You really are, but at the same time, you get so invested while you're watching it. And then you think about these things later and you're like, wait a second.
Yeah, screw that. Okay. I didn't remember the little surprise at the end. And I think for me, this is one of the ones that suffers from the Stephen King weird ending like phenomena, where I was like, okay, I'll buy a tiny Rambo toy coming hidden in the box and like messing this dude up. But a thermonuclear device. He just, like, there's just a tiny nuke inside this toy? How? How did that happen?
Yeah.
Like, I guess he's irradiated the whole block now.
Yeah, just ruined it for everyone.
It's so wild.
Oh. Yeah, it was one of those endings where you're like, you know, maybe they should have ended it when he heard the noise in the pool.
Oh my God. Yeah. I loved the, cause he gets slashed in the wrist, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's really scary and sinister. Yeah. Ending it in the pool or when he gets in the elevator and it like stops, and you're just like, yeah. Oh, you don't even know what that is.
It's like, oh, doom. Okay. We're done.
And no more.
Yeah. Some of the endings can be tough. I think he usually does a little bit of a better job with the short stories, just because everything's so much tighter than the novels and not nearly as drawn out. But this one, you're kind of like, I could have done without that ending or just ending sooner.
But overall, I think this was really like, this one was a solid one, and it's a good way to start the series, I think.
Yeah, and much like his collections, these stories are drastically different.
Yes.
From episode to episode, which I think is okay, because they were going for that Twilight Zone feel. I was reading my Stephen King at the Movies book just before we hopped on here, and it's like they didn't want to do something exactly like Creepshow, so they kind of leaned into the Twilight Zone feel a little more for this. And I still think, you know, Creepshow is probably better, because I think it just ties it all together in a different, unique way that kind of makes it so even when the stories aren't thematically the same, you still have that wraparound story that kind of gives you like, hey, we're just going to tell you some stories. Whereas this is just like, on to the next episode. And, you know, for us, the next episode is Crouch End.
I like a good frame story for things as well. I think even in Twilight Zone, you had Rod as your kind of connective thread, which I think works really well. I think you're right. I almost wish there was some sort of connective tissue here too. Yeah, Crouch End. I remember reading the story. I really like the prose story. I thought that he tells it out of order in the prose story, and here it's very straightforward, which I like telling this out of order. I think it ups the tension. I found myself watching this and going, I am actually super okay with them getting, whatever happens to them, I'm fine. Like, The dude is so unlikable that you're like, man, I can't wait for you to get Stephen King. Whatever happens, I can't wait for it, man.
Especially when the wife is just like, we should get help. We are lost. And he's just like, no, we're not.
This whole collection had kind of a little bit of a theme of dysfunctional marriage, which is kind of a theme in Stephen King's writing, so fair enough. But like this collection in particular, you're like, if y'all would just talk to each other. Like, guys, everyone involved, please. I like the idea a lot for this one. I love a good thin spot story. I'd love a good, Americans messing up abroad story, because it just makes me feel good inside to watch. People get their comeuppance when they act a fool in other people's countries. And I do love anything that even like nods to Cthulhu mythos. I'm a big Cthulhu mythos fan. And so like it has all of the ingredients to be something that I definitely do enjoy. Creepy kids, that's always good.
Yes. I think with this one, because they're in a foreign location, like you said, and you have this couple trying to find the husband's coworker, basically, who he has never met, because obviously he is not from here, and he gets this address that's in Crouch End, and all of a sudden the thin spot comes into play, like you were saying. And I think the practical effects hold up really well, but the CGI not so much. Brutal. Like when you have it coming out of the street and you're just like, oh, all right.
But they do, some of the practical stuff is actually really, really effective. Like I love the kid's claw hand. I thought that was really cool. Can't remember if this is the intro or in the episode. There's that goo, that like black goo that's on him that looked like it's burning through his coat. That's in the actual episode, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that was really cool. From the beginning of the episode, I was like, wait, so this dude is supposedly taking his wife on, like, is this their honeymoon?
Yes.
So it's their honeymoon, which he promised her, like, this is our honeymoon, so we can honeymoon it up. And he's like, no, but I have to do all this work stuff that's super inconvenient for us. Cool. All right. So that's annoying, but sometimes work calls. And then, like, they could just beg off. Like, he could just be like, we tried, man. Continues not to do that. Gets into a fight with his wife about it. Multiple cabbies are like, nah, we don't go there, man. Look, I feel like he was just, you're missing all of the Lord signs, whichever Lord that is. Like you're just missing all of the signs of the universe. Like, don't go. Like, I don't know. There's even like the black character that tells him not to go. Like, I just don't understand, man. Like, just listen. And the poor woman is like, I just want to go back to the hotel and enjoy my honeymoon, man. Like, can we just do that? It was wild. Also, his coworker is a jerk. He's like, hey, I live in this super haunted neighborhood. Can you just get here?
And then he immediately loses the address.
Yes. And then this part was confusing to me, but I sometimes get confused. So maybe you can explain it to me. They go to Crouch End with finally one cabbie that will take them. And then he hops out and he goes into a call box, a phone booth, and presumably to call his coworker because he didn't have the address, right? Like that's what they discussed in the car. But
yeah.
It does not sound like he's doing that at all. It doesn't. He's just like chatting about whatever, doesn't have a pen and paper, doesn't have anything to record it. And then after that, doesn't seem to know where they're going. Like,
and it's like you couldn't just have him come pick you up at like the entrance of the town or at the phone booth or something.
Yeah, seriously. I was like, what is happening? Oh my God.
I think this was American man does not want to admit he got lost in foreign place syndrome.
Definitely. Definitely. This is also a theme that comes up in this as well, right? We'll get to it later on, but in the last episode too, it was just this almost the same scenario, but they've been married for a while. And you're just like, Stephen, I think maybe you need to go to therapy. I think,
like... Yeah. And then he turns into a cat.
Yes. Question mark? Right? But like, I mean, all from the cat already existed? I don't know. It's so confusing.
it seems like things are not explained very well in The Thin Spot, because you have just like a giant hole in someone's yard too that he has to go investigate. And that's when he gets the goo on him. And
the smoking hole.
Yeah. And then Doris, who is the wife, she's like having these weird flashes of things, and it's like she can't function. And then there's this big portal that opens and everything is flying into it. There is so much that happens in this episode, truly.
And that's not even the end of the episode either, too, because after that, then they go back. Oh, God, that's right. You reminded me. Yes. Yes. Like, she's been having like bad omen things, and like they set up that she's super superstitious.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't listen to her at all. Of course. Of course. That's just how it goes. And she's like seeing things like creepy, like people who change into werewolves on the street, and then these two kids who are little monsters, and like the cat with the one chewed up eye. And she's just like, all right, I'm still gonna listen to my husband. I would not be in that situation, but I would have been like, we're divorced now. This is my honeymoon, but it's time to go. And then like there's a smoking hole, and he's like, somebody might be hurt. I'm like, what led you to believe that? I'm always the first person to jump in if somebody needs help. But what led you to believe about this smoking hole that someone was hurt? Like, what? And then he sees his future, kind of, and he makes her run deeper into the place instead of, like, to freedom. Oh, my God. I want to see. This is what I'm talking about. I was like, I hope you get super Stephen King'd. I hope.
She should have just been like, nah, the cabbie left. He just straight up left us. I'm done.
Yeah. The cabbie leaves, but he doesn't really leave. He just disappears because they kind of go through the thin spot. Like, it's just drifting. And I'm just like, yo, it's time. Like, it's time to leave. Like, do not, like, there are three times where you're like, if you would just go, you would be fine. They go to the police department, and there's like, it clearly some sort of monster attack happened there, but like, he's super chill about it. He's like, oh, there was no one there.
Because that's normal.
It's like, look at all the claw marks.
Yeah. And you also have the fact that, if I'm not mistaken, the whole series was filmed in Australia, and they did a really nice job of making this look like London, at least.
I've only been to London once, but
I have never been. I just assume this is what it looks like.
I think they did a really good job of in each one of making it kind of feel like where it's supposed to be for the most part. Clearly you have to suspend a little disbelief, but as a New Yorker who sees things that are quote unquote in New York, I'm like, I am already well-versed just like overlooking stuff.
Yeah.
But I love that, like, the cabbie stuff was great, and they shot really tightly on the streets when they were, you know, in regular London, which I thought was really smart, because that way it makes it feel kind of like the, like, weird, they have a lot of weird streets over there. A lot of weird streets and a lot of very, very wild driving. So I was like, all right, this feels pretty good.
Yeah, that seems pretty accurate. But I thought this one was not necessarily as strong as Battleground, because like you said, the story kind of goes out of order, but for a visual representation, it kind of makes sense to go a little more chronologically. But yeah, he was just so annoying. I was like, ugh.
I think that if we had started a little closer to them, like, getting into Crouch End and spent a little bit more time building up the weirdness, I think it would have been a little stronger, because you spend a lot more time in the real world than you would think for such a short episode. Whereas I'm like, I want to know what was in that hole.
Yeah.
Like, what was that?
Or the creature in the, like, underpass kind of thing under the bridge.
Yeah. I think it was the cat. I'm not sure, but I think it was like a giant. Yeah, but like the eye was the same. I don't know. It was really hard to see down there. So they did a good job with that stuff. There were a couple of moments of true dread where I was like, okay, oh shoot. Like when he goes into the police department, there are all these little details that are so creepy that he's, I don't know if it's purposeful, because they do kind of play it like the place is messing with his mind in particular, or, you know, or if he's just being willfully ignorant when he looks into the police department. But like, there's a lot of detail stuff where you're like, hey, this is not good. Like, and then him forgetting what hurt him was really like, that's so creepy. And I'm like, oh, just give me like a solid 45 of that.
Yeah. And, you know, this next story that we dive into takes us to a totally different time period. You know, we spend a lot of time in the 1930s in Los Angeles, so not London by any stretch of the imagination, but also not Los Angeles because, as I just said, not filmed on location for any of these.
Although the houses, the stucco houses that they had, I was like, this feels very California. This is solid, man. My wife's also from California, and she was like, she was watching it with me because I made her. She was like, oh, I really miss the stucco houses of my youth. It's like, all right. It passed the California test.
Yeah, it definitely felt like one of those neighborhoods, like pre-downtown LA being really built up and stuff like that. So that was really fun to see. And, you know, another broken marriage in this one. It's something that King seems to be very good at writing, which is a little worrying, if you ask me.
I mean, if you're working it out through the page and not in real life, I guess, like, or not, like, fighting with each other, then that's better, I guess.
Yeah, that is true. With this one, though, it's also a big commentary on how I think he felt as a writer, because by this point, you know, this series came out in 2006, so many of his works had already been adapted that he literally got to see a lot of his characters brought to life. And yeah. That's exactly, well, not exactly, because this is just like two realities colliding. Basically, you have Clyde Umney, who is the character written by this crime fiction author, both played by William H. Macy, which is crazy when you see one person playing off of themselves and you know that they had to do some trickery to get this to happen on the screen.
And they do a good job of making them look distinct. Like, clearly yeah. It's the same person, but like, honestly, the writer version looks like Stephen King.
Yes. I was like, oh, look at those dad shoes.
The dad shoes, the glasses. Oh, man. I thought that this one, it felt almost at first like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Because it was, even though there are no cartoons, it was very cartoony. Like,
I almost expected one to show up.
You do. You're like, oh, my God. Like, this is so, like, old school absurdist noir. But I like the idea of the story a lot, that you have this character who this writer has poured all of the quote unquote good parts of himself into, and he uses the character to escape all the messed up stuff that's happening in his own life instead of just dealing with it like a grown up, which is also a theme with Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's very similar to, you know, Jack Torrance in The Shining and a couple of other characters like that, where it's like, no, I'm just going to ignore everything that's happening and just pour it all into my work.
Yeah, and with the Umney portion of the story, I don't know if this is maybe because I watched the new Perry Mason recently, but it felt very similar in tone. You know, he goes home, he's by himself, he hears his neighbors blaring music and can see them dancing from like his bathroom window, which is really creepy. But
he's drinking in the bathroom watching them dance.
Yeah. And you kind of just get this feeling that despite how charismatic he seemed in the office, and, you know, he was having this sort of fling with his secretary lady and then the lady who came in, and he gets back to his place and he's just a lonely man.
I wish for that, because I thought that he very purposefully was like, these are all the tropes of noir.
Yes.
And this guy is like number one in that. I wish that, like, when you get the switch later, that we see him not fitting into the real world because he's so tropey, instead of like kind of weirdly succeeding all over the place. But I thought that it was really interesting that you had this guy who did have it all. Like, he didn't have to be alone.
Right.
Like, there was that really nice lady that was the love of his life that, like, he could have been with, but the writer chooses to keep them apart because that's going to give him more story juice for later. And you have this character suffering because of that. I thought that was really interesting. It makes me bummed to think that there's a universe where all the things I do to my characters is actually happening to people. That's so sad.
Yeah. And it's almost like this power move, because the writer in his own life is having struggles. It's actually a very dark story because it's like his son dies by drowning in a pool because, well, it's kind of their fault because all of the adults were in the house while the children were in the pool.
Yeah, not a single one of them was actually watching the kids. I remember when I was watching it, I was like, who is watching the children? Like, why is there not one adult there?
Yeah, you're like, they're gonna kill a child right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's this like this examination of guilt and of not being able to let go. Like his wife, the writer's wife, like they go to the kid's grave every single day and like it's so heavy for them, like it's so much. And the writer doesn't want to do it anymore. But, you know, the wife's like, well, he's alone. Like, I'm not going to leave him alone.
Yeah.
But then also like she clearly like everyone needs therapy.
Yes.
And she keeps trying even after all this time to reach out to the writer, and the writer just absolutely shuts her out. And then I feel almost like when the switch happens, Stephen forgets, or whoever wrote the screenplay, because I don't remember what happens in the actual short story, but they forget that she's supposed to be a real world character because she becomes almost like someone from the universe. Like she becomes this, like the same damsel,
yeah,
that like he's been dealing with in his own life. And I almost wish that like she had been much more centered and like had a stronger foundation, because I wanted to see Omni kind of failing and realizing that like if he's going to take any sort of responsibility for himself, like he tells her like at one point, like Omni can't change, you know, this is who I am. Like he's like a cheater and a boozer and whatever. And it's like, well, you're in the real world now. You can do whatever you want. You're no longer bound by the laws of your own world. And so I wish that we'd actually gotten that instead of the wife becoming more of one of his characters. But, you know, again, this one scared me on a deep level because the idea of accident, I mean, he does it on purpose. The writer purposefully goes into the other world, but the idea of accidentally slipping into like a world of my writing, I write horror as well. That's right. So scary to me. Like, I don't want to go. No, I write about it so it doesn't happen.
I don't want my characters to take revenge on me.
Yeah. He tortures Clyde. To prepare him for his arrival, he tortures him. And I'm like, why? Wouldn't you want to set things up so that it's better there? So that you can step into something better instead of like complicating everything? Like, I just don't. And he like purposefully like hurts people to mess with Clyde. And I'm like, like your wife should have left you a long time ago. Like this is a cruel streak. This has nothing to do with the tragedy that you've endured. Like you're just a bully. That whole speech that Clyde gives him is so good. I'm like, yes, he is a bully and bullies shouldn't prosper. Like this is, what are we learning here?
Yeah. I will give him some credit for the fun little scene where he's practicing how he's going to answer the phone.
That is so cute. Yes. Yeah.
Once he's in Omni's world, he's just like trying all these different ways to pick up the phone when it rings.
I love too that like they have this conversation where Sam Landry is the writer. Sam is like, you're all the good parts of me. You're smarter. You know, like you're quippy. Like you always know the right thing to do and the right thing to say. And I always freeze. Like I never know what to do. So I'm going to switch places with you. And then when he's in that world, he's still himself. He hasn't become Clyde Omni. So he still like doesn't know what to say or what to do in any situation. And so like when a client comes in, like he can't handle it. He's very, very bad at it. And you're like, yeah, you can't escape who you are, no matter what your circumstances, you know, around you are. You are yourself. You can't escape yourself. And I was like, all right, that's really solid. Like, that's good stuff. And I think that did it in a way that was subtle, but impactful.
Yeah. And I want to say this one kind of fits in the least with the whole series that they did here, because it's very much so of a different time. It's a different kind of horror that isn't necessarily dreadful like some of these other ones, and especially the one we're about to get into where you're just like, oh no.
Yeah, for sure. This is another one where like you said, like they could have extended the tension and dread by waiting longer to introduce the writer, by slowly making things start to change and have only Omni notice that they changed. Like, I really like the scene where like the kid what's his name, Peoria or something like that. He's like, oh, like my mom won the lottery and I'm not going to be blind anymore and all this stuff. And he's like, no, this is what? This is wrong. This is not how this is supposed to go. If they'd done that a couple more times, like peppered that throughout, I think that it would have been a lot more tense. But, you know, a good attempt at noir.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah, I wouldn't put this on par with Perry Mason, which I recently watched again, but, you know, it was one of those things where it just kind of takes you back to that time and you're like, oh, okay, here's a fun little trip to 1930s Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I love that. Yeah, that scene where he's like, what year is it? And he's like, 38. No, wait, 39. No, wait. What's the date? And you're like, yes, keep it vague. I love it because it's so true. It's like I've been reading Agatha Christie lately. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. That's what it feels like. You're just like, I don't know, this vague time.
Vague place. Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah, it was. And the next story actually, you know, has its own family dynamic going on. And for once, you know, it's not a husband and wife, at least. It's a brotherly relationship that I think is portrayed pretty well. I don't have siblings, so I can't really speak to this, but I was like, this seems like what siblings would be going through together if they were in this kind of situation. And, you know, the one brother played by Henry Thomas, he's someone who appears in later Stephen King adaptations again. And I kind of always like finding these actors who return to Stephen King in one way or another. And there's another actress later on that is also in multiple adaptations, but, you know, he pops up in Dr. Sleep and basically almost everything Mike Flanagan does.
Oh my God, that's right. Oh, that's right. He is in Dr. Sleep.
Yeah. And I think he like had a little tiny appearance in Gerald's Game too.
I didn't watch that one because it's so stressful. Like, oh, the book is so stressful. I was like, I can't see this come to life. I can imagine that was very creepy and very well done though. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, there were a couple of return people in this, but I really liked this one. I think this might have been my favorite one of the bunch. I really liked Battleground as well, but
yeah, this one's very dire. Very, very dire.
It's so stressful. I have lots of siblings. And I really like the way that the brothers' relationship was portrayed. It's not what I experienced with most of my siblings, but I really like Stephen King kind of trades in familial and romantic strife a lot.
Mm-hmm. Also, I imagine none of your siblings are throwing a wasp nest at you.
I mean, listen, there's one that we tried to kill each other multiple times. So like, I mean, now we're the best of friends, but when we grew up, we were like feral wild animals. He almost cut off my finger. I stabbed him in the head with a pencil. It's a lot.
Oh, our siblings that's fun. Can be a lot.
Love him to death.
Maybe I'm not missing out on anything.
Love him to death. Would absolutely kill for him. But, you know. But, like, I really loved that we had a story here that easily they could have been rivals, right? The setup is that, like, the older, you know, the parents are super geniuses. The older brother is very smart, but he's more of a creative type, and the younger brother is an uber super genius. But I love that he's just like, no, I love my kid brother. Just... we're inseparable. That's my boy. I help raise him. He's my, you know, he's my best friend. And I'm like, oh, that makes everything that happens all the sadder, mm-hmm. all the more bittersweet. Yeah, this was the one that scared me the most because I'm the most sympathetic towards like the characters. And it's just like, oh no, I don't want anything bad to happen to you. Oh boy. But you start off knowing that bad things have already happened. And you're like, oh no, these poor boys, these poor, poor boys. Yeah. An apocalypse story, right? Here we are again, Stephen.
On the brink of nuclear war, and their solution is to have a volcano blow.
Man, I found it interesting because I read the story multiple times. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly it's written in the early 90s. And then this was made in, what'd you say? It was six?
Yes. 2006.
And in the short story, Stephen invents some like really horrific global kind of terrorist things that happen. Uh-huh. It's like in London and what is it? Japan or somewhere else. With these just like really terrible escalating things to kind of show that the world is out of control. And then when they made this show, they were just like 9/11. It's just like, we don't even have to, it's just, here it is. Here you go. And it was so soon after that happened in 06, that I'm sure to anyone in New York, it was just like immediately, or the whole country, honestly, like we're still suffering the effects of all the terrible things that came out of that with our government, as is the rest of the world. That was such an easy shorthand. We're just like, yeah, no, you're right. Everything's super out of control. Yep. Like, and then you're kind of like, I am very sympathetic to wanting to find a way to just make people chill the fuck out. Everybody relax. Take it easy.
Especially after you and I read something like Cell, where these people are just losing their minds because of cell phones, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, we definitely need people to chill out.
Get some of that chill out juice.
Yeah, so basically this story is kind of, how do we get humans to be nice to each other? And you mentioned how many geniuses are in the family, but there is something that goes wrong with the water supply. And you're seeing, you know, the sick parents, and they don't even remember who Howard is, really, by the end of the conversation. And I think that's something a lot of people can relate to as grandparents or parents get older. And, you know, sometimes they have health problems that make them forget who you are. And I imagine that's something that's very difficult to go through. But Howard is willing to go through it because he has a story he wants to tell. He's the creative one. You know, he is doing all of this to get the story out there as to what really happened. And when you see what he goes through when his brother is like, I need you to inject me, and then it kills him.
Oh, so brutal.
It is so brutal. And you can tell that Bobby just wants the best for everyone. And then that makes it even more heartbreaking.
Yeah, the conversation that kind of starts it all off. I think that, like, this was also one of the ones that was the truest to the story itself, like the short story, like from the setup and the frame story to everything else and the progression. But there's a conversation between them when Bobby, the younger brother, is supposedly a teenager, but clearly a full-grown man. Where he's just like, why are people so mean to each other? Like, I don't understand. Yeah. And how he's like, it just is. Like, that's basically what it boils down to. He's like, who cares? Like, I don't know. We're wired that way, whether it's God or your biology, who cares? Like, we're just terrible. And you know, and that's such an older sibling kind of attitude. As an older sibling, that definitely feels legit. And then Bobby's like, beautiful, optimistic heart. He's like, no, we don't have to be bad. We don't have to be mean. And to have a genius in a story want to use their genius for the ultimate good, even if it goes wrong, I think is also really nice. It's really easy to make a genius maniacal and evil, but
a lot of them come off as selfish when they're portrayed on screen. And he is the exact opposite of that.
Exactly. And I think that that's really wonderful, because I think that we tend to equate intelligence with cruelty and coldness. We're kind of like socialized to think that way. And we're socialized to think that lack of intelligence leads to things like empathy. It's like, no, that's not it at all. And so to have this genius character be the ultimate poster boy for empathy, where he's just like, no, we just have to like listen to each other and be good to each other, and I'm gonna make it happen. I think that's really smart. But like, so this conversation, right, like coming out of that and seeing how it drives this person to use all of his mental power, but also like just devote his life to figuring out a way how to save people, is, you just want him to succeed so badly. And I think that, you know, they don't make the connection, the water connection, very well.
Yeah, that was a little less obvious.
Yeah, it's just a little clunky. But like the idea that someone that is so smart would also not see something that is so obvious is also very, like, that being driven and myopic, even if you mean well, means that you're missing things. And that's why you need to work with people, is such also a smart kind of message to show people. It's like, no, not, no one person can save us all. We all have to work together. But his plan to use this water from this small town in Texas, which there's no violence in this town, right? Like it's like the center of what he calls a comquake. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of taking that resource and trying to apply it to the whole world, I think that's all really beautiful. And as someone too, who I lost my grandmother to Alzheimer's, she like raised me. She was one of my parents. The way that they depict the mother kind of forgetting stuff was like really impactful. Sorry, I'm getting ahead too. The plot is they drop all of this super concentrated calming water into a volcano. It goes off and then it blankets the globe and all water becomes this calming water, but it makes your brain into like basically pudding.
Like, yeah.
And it's just, you're just like these poor boys. And the idea as an older sibling too, of like, you know, this guy's younger brother is like, I found a way to save us all and I need your help. I'm your, you know, please, I need you. The idea of telling him no, I couldn't fathom it either. Like, how do you?
Especially when you see how excited he is, like when he sticks his hand in with the wasps, you know, to sting him out of however many 100 or 200 are in there.
God, yeah, that's this particular episode. The story too, but like the episode, I think does a very good job of pushing this idea is a perfect example of like the road to hell being paved with good intentions.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they do a really good job of kind of pushing that. I think all of the characters are super sympathetic,
mm-hmm.
Which unlike the last like couple of episodes, you're just like, oh, I'm rooting for you 100%, but you already know that it's not going to end well. And the frame story of the older brother telling their story to a camera as he slowly deteriorates is heartbreaking as well. Holy God. I'm sorry. I'm like getting a little emotional just thinking about it. I thought they did a really good job with this episode. This one got me.
And Ron Livingston and Henry Thomas play off of each other so well that you kind of believe they could be brothers.
Yeah. I thought that the whole family felt really real. I mean, clearly like they had to shorthand a couple of things, but like,
yeah,
when they're interacting with each other, it feels very much like a family that is completely rooted in love and understanding, which is really, really nice. It's so rare to see in any sort of horror thing that I was just like, what a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I really liked how everything wrapped up with the end of the whole mess. And given the title, like you said, you do know it's not going to end well. You know, it's a mess, obviously. But the next story, I found this read very, very interesting when I read it in the collection. And mm-hmm. I think they did a pretty good job with The Road Virus Heads North. And it stars Tom Berenger. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's really about this writer who has like crazy fans, but then he also has this love for garage sales and he just picks up this random painting and he takes it with him as he's heading back home from like his book tour or whatever it is. And he stops by, is it his sister's house?
His aunt, I think.
His aunt, okay.
I think it's his aunt.
They look to be the same age. So I was like, this doesn't really track.
I know. He's supposed to be 50. I was like, nah.
Yeah. That's why I was like, sister? No, that didn't sound right. So thank you for knowing that information because just felt a little off.
And later on when you see his former girlfriend, you're like, she's half your age, brother. Like, there's no way.
Yeah, it really does feel like they cast him quite a bit older than I think King intended the character to be.
I think so too. I think that like looking at him, I'm like, he's supposed to be in his 40s, maybe, right? Like
maybe.
This guy, unless he's had a hard 40s, but he says he's like 50, I think. The parts that stood out to me were like all of the like things in his actual life. The horror stuff to me actually didn't, with the exception of like one thing, I was just like, this is okay. Like, this is fine.
Yeah.
But this is exactly what I expected. But like the interpersonal stuff stood out a little to me. So that's why I have any detail about that. But I think he says to the doctor that he's like 50. So he'd outlived both of his parents or whatever, like gotten farther than they did.
Right. Because he basically gets some bad news at the doctor's and he's like, eh, okay, whatever kind of thing about it. And
yeah, I expected this.
Yeah. And he goes to see, like you said, his former girlfriend, and she's like doing all this.
I loved her.
You know, kind of spiritual stuff in a sauna type thing. And he's just like, it's very hot in here. And she's like, yeah, duh.
She's like, yes, you're sweating out the damn toxins. I really liked him talking to his aunt and then his girlfriend, or his former girlfriend, who's watching his dog.
Yeah.
Because his aunt's like, yo, what's going on? Because he seems bummed. And he tells her and she's just like, fuck up. Like, it's, you know, it's not so bad. We don't know what it is yet. It's just all preliminary. Like, you just got to think positive. And then his girlfriend, former girlfriend or whatever, like, he ends up telling her, even though he didn't mean to, because he's trying to create distance. And she's just like, I can't believe you're going to try and do this alone. Like, no, like, this is a big deal. Like, you need to, you know, you can't keep it all inside. That's going to make you feel worse. Like, let me help you. And I was like, oh, those are totally different approaches, but they feel really real. Like, those feel really real. And it makes you care about these women.
Mm-hmm. I love how the aunt is just immediately like, why did you buy this hideous painting?
Yeah, yo, that's cursed. I was like, she has kind of a southern accent, so she knows what she's talking about. Even though they're in Maine or whatever.
Right. And then the former girlfriend is just like, I threw it away. And
I didn't even look at it.
Yeah. And we know it's not going away.
I love it. I love it because, like, I didn't know how it would translate to video, to moving images. Cause I love this short story. It's creepy as heck. And I think there are certain things that are hard to do in the language of film that you can do easily in prose. But I really, like, I was actually scared for these two women, because he realizes that it's going all the places where he was and killing there. And, like, that was where the tension was for me, not for when it got to him. I was like, you already have resigned yourself to die.
Right.
I'm like, save them, figure out how to save them.
Turns out we needed to be terrified for the dog.
Oh my God. That was, like, the worst. That was the thing.
As soon as the dog ran downstairs, I was like, that's it.
Yeah, like, the killer ends up killing the character in the painting who comes to life, question mark, is already alive, whatever. The rock and roll cannibal. He kills, like, a human woman, and I'm like, oh, that sucks, bro. And then he kills the dog, and I'm like, no!
How dare you?
That was the only horror thing that got me. I was like, oh no, hobo. Who names their dog hobo? Stephen King.
I was like, did I hear that correctly?
It's a lot. Listen, for a man who was hit by a car in which there was a dog named, what was it, Bullet or Pistol, or both Bullet and Pistol? You know what? You can name the dog whatever you want. You can get as weird with it as you want.
Yeah, you can. You can. And what I love about this one, though, is that it's left open-ended, kind of like how we wish Battleground would have been left a little more open-ended. You get that final scene and you're just like, okay, we know nothing good is going to happen, but we don't know how bad whatever that is going to happen is going to be.
Yeah, in the short story, it almost seems like he's going to wreck this cannibal. And in this, it's just like, you don't know what it's, you literally, you're like, he's going to face it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate. I'm like, I think it takes the whole story for him to finally be like, wait, my life is worth fighting for. And so I do like that, where he's just like, whatever is happening, I'm going to face it on my feet. You know, so that's, I like that idea for an ending. Good job, Steve.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I've never really read any interviews or heard any interviews where Stephen King talks about his love for cars, but it really seems like he has this love for older cars, because you have, you know, sort of that 50s era with Christine, and then you have a lot of muscle cars that appear throughout his movies and the TV adaptations and whatnot. And this is one of those, because the killer has this, you know, souped up muscle car, and there's another car we will talk about later because I need to talk about it, not because it's important to the story. But I really think that this was a more subtle use of the car.
I liked it. I wish we had seen more of the killer's car, Because I agree. I love it. I love that idea. I love that when you do finally see it at the end, it says the road virus on it. I'm a mark for that kind of silliness. I understand that others are not.
Yeah.
But I love that kind of stuff. Like the license plate in Jeepers Creepers. I'm like, that's so good. That's so, the bee eating you. Oh, so good. So I like that. Like the back window says like the road virus. And it purrs like a kitten. Like I'm like, oh, yeah. I too would like to see more of your car. Am I on your side? Yeah. No, probably, but.
Yeah. And I mean, to go from this car to very crappy car in the fifth quarter, you're just like, meh. Okay. And this one, it felt different because the color tone when you're watching it just felt so drab and, you know, maybe, well, I assume that's what prison is like. I wouldn't know, but you really get this idea that I don't know if maybe they just didn't want to use as much of the budget on this one, but it is not very well lit at all in comparison to, I think, all of the ones that come before and even after it.
I agree. I feel like this was the forgotten child of like the whole anthology. It felt very much like there was very little tension to go along with the drab color. I think like, because it's such a simple, straightforward story, I think they needed to do more stuff with how they told it or how they shot it. And they were just like, we spent so much money on that car in the last one. And all on the 17 paintings that we had to have people paint because it changes.
And the ginormous house.
And the ginormous house. And in the end of the whole mess as well, there's like a super fancy like apartment because like the brother is like a hotshot documentarian. So like we got $7 left this week. All right. The fifth quarter. This one was just like the crime version of Treasure Island to me.
Yeah, it was very out of place. I think this and Omni's Last Case maybe could have been the two that were separate from the rest of this, because there's a certain level of horror in all of the other stories that really isn't there for the crime driven stories. You know, Omni being a private detective and the fifth quarter with this convict getting out of jail and immediately going back. You know, Jeremy Sisto was definitely not the law and order part of this. And then you have Samantha Mathis, who had been in the 2004 Salem's Lot and goes on to be in Under the Dome. So I was kind of hoping for more out of this one, given, you know, those two characters and who they were played by. And then I honestly didn't even really remember reading this story to begin with.
It starts with him at what's his name's house, like holding him up and Sarge coming in, but it's a much different. Okay. So the only thing that really stood out to me about this story, I'm sorry, this is one that I was struggling to try and figure out a positive thing to say, because I try very hard to at least find a positive thing and even things that I don't particularly like.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I did like about this is you have the scene where Willie, he's the convict that gets out of jail, goes back to his family. His best friend had been staying with his wife and his son, helping her out in the trailer, and because he didn't have anywhere to go. And then his friend comes in and he's been shot, and it's his friend's final moments. And like, it becomes very clear that there was like a relationship between the best friend and the wife. And instead of Willie being like, go, you know.
And I think his name's Jerry in the story, so they might have changed that for the episode.
Maybe I'm wrong. Was it? I don't remember. See, this is how much
it's something that ends in like a Y-I-E, you know?
Yeah. But he, you know, he comforts his friends in his last moments.
Yeah.
And his friend is like, you and Karen, you know, Karen deserved it. I think her name was Karen. You and your wife deserve this. You know, I love you both. Like, and I was like, are they all three together? Because that's the vibe I'm getting. Like, Willie's really holding in his face and like putting the forehead to get like, this is, I'm getting a very Polly like vibe from this whole thing. And I was like, it's not in the story, but you certainly seem to be pushing it as actors, and I'm into it. So that's something that I really liked about it, where it's like a vengeance story and he's avenging his best friend slash the third in their throuple. And I was like, this is cute. I like that. Let's that's my headcanon for this.
Yeah, he was certainly not fazed by his wife having an affair.
He almost seemed to expect it. And he was equal, like, as soon as he got out, like, or he's talking to his wife while he's inside before he gets out. And his, like, main concern is his like making sure that his friend is okay and that she's okay, like, and the kid too, but like that their family is okay. And I was like, I really like the way they're playing this, man.
Yeah, the kid does kind of get the short end of the stick though, as far as his concern.
Yeah, that's true. This one was forgettable. As it was happening, I couldn't remember reading most of the story either. So I was just making wild assumptions in my brain. I was like, how will this finish? And to me, I was like, oh, the Stephen King of it all, because these two ideas about women, the king of it all is that she's orchestrated this whole thing so that all the men in her life die and mm-hmm. she gets rich and can run away with this kid. And that is not what happened. And I was like, I'm very surprised, because this in Stephen King stuff, by and large, women are either like helpless damsels who are super emotional for the most part.
Or they're like the most powerful character in the story.
Yeah, but like pure evil.
There's no in between.
Like absolute pure evil. Like there's almost no in between, with a few exceptions. What's her name? Alice from The Cell being an exception. But so I was like, I'm so wildly surprised. She's not really like, I mean, she's a victim of circumstance, but she's not like a super damsel. Like she's like, I've been holding it down and doing my business. So, and she's also not pure evil. So that's another good thing. Good on you, Stephen.
Yeah, I do agree that this one's kind of the most forgettable. And the next story we have coming up, I wanted more out of it. And I think that's because, you know, it's Autopsy Room 4, which stars the original Bill Denborough, Richard Thomas. Yeah. So you have that fun little connection there. But, oh boy, do we see more of him than I ever wanted to see.
Ooh, you know, this is unfair of me, but I also wanted much more from this story. There's a very similar story that is an episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Uh-huh.
And it is the funnier, more messed up version of this. This is just the, like, for me, this was very paint by numbers, almost adding in a lot more crass stuff than I was strictly necessary, of course. I don't know, man. This is another one where I was like, ay, ay,
ay, ay. Like, it works so much better as a story, because when you read this, it's the first story that kicks off everything's eventual. And I instantly was drawn in by this story, and then to have this, and, you know, it's not that I don't like Richard Thomas, it's just that it's so much voiceover that I don't think this translates as well. And not to mention they're golfing and the snake doesn't even look real, and you're just like, okay. And you're like, of course, the guy who is seen as the idiot is the one who's going to be right. And the whole, like, love affair thing in the morgue.
That was so weird.
I was like, this feels like it came out of Kingdom Hospital with how wacky it is, because there was like a whole love affair in that thing that was very, very bizarre. Weird. And I felt the same exact way when I saw this one. I was like, I don't think we needed this.
I think this is one of the ones that should have stayed prose. Too much voiceover work, and it was not well suited. Like the dialogue, monologue, whatever itself, wasn't well suited for the medium. Where like you can do voiceover stuff, but like to have someone just saying exactly what's happening, but with more exclamation points. Like I don't need that. Like I see what's happening, I can't think of a way to fix that for this. Right? Because it's like you have to hear his internal thoughts in order for you to have any sort of like, you know, tension and dread. I don't know.
I think there was too much of the talking.
I agree. I wish that
they should have cut like half of it out.
I 100% agree. I almost wish that he also started off more drugged, not drugged, but like from the poison, where he's just like, I don't know what's going on. Like, and then built into panic instead of immediately being at 11 and then having to maintain that for the whole story.
Yeah. It was a lot.
Nakey. Super nakey. And like, I get it. Like I too was 17 once. I used to find that kind of humor kind of funny, but I was just like, I get it. You got a stiffy, man. The stiff's got a stiffy. It's why is this going on for more than literally 2 seconds? Like that part of it goes on for over 5 minutes.
Yeah, they were like trying to find a medical explanation for it. And I was like, he's not dead. That's the explanation.
Also, yeah, I mean, clearly, and he but also, like, there's a point where the guy, I think his name is Rusty, he like jabs a needle into his junk or whatever, for whatever reason, I forget why now. Corpses don't bleed. Like, he was using, you know, using the syringe as a, you know, to suck out whatever fluids were in there. But like, he would, like, because he's alive, he would have been bleeding. Yeah. Like, the way that he got absolutely stabbed, like, he would start bleeding. And it's like, as soon as you see that, you're like, yo, this dude isn't dead. And there was no rigor mortis, there's no lividity, there's no, like, any of that. I was like, yo, I'm no expert. I've only read a couple of books about it and also watched unbelievable amounts of procedurals, but even I know this very basic fact about, like, dead bodies. How did everyone miss it?
It's like, do you know how many Law and Orders and NCISs I have watched? Come on.
Let me tell you, my mom is a big fan of procedurals. I've seen them all right? And the off brands. But, like, that's one thing that I know, like, I just through research for my job, is dead bodies don't bleed. There's no heart pumping the blood. So if you get, like, bleeding, not just a little leakage, but bleeding, which is what would happen, you'd be like, oh, my man's alive. Also, they look dead at those viper bites and they're like, it's mosquito bites. I'm like, there's no way a snake bite looks like a mosquito bite.
I think one of the guys was like, oh, it's just a defect in the socks. I was like, what?
Oh, yeah, little vampire marks. I'm like, stop. Yeah, all fired. Oh my God. Yeah, this one was another one where I was like, I could have done without it. Maybe.
Yeah, this one was one of those where you're like, maybe not everything of King's needs to be adapted, and we really don't need to keep, you know, kind of trying to do the ones that probably shouldn't be adapted. Like, there's a reason some of his books have not been adapted yet.
Yes. Some of them just can't. Sometimes, I mean, I think that that's not a bad thing, though.
Right.
I think that, like, motion picture is a different medium with different language than prose, which is completely different than comics, right? So, like, these are very distinct languages that you have to be able to speak, and some things just don't translate. And I just don't think that, I don't think this one did it. Omni's Last Case either. Even though I think that they did a better job with Omni's Last Case than they did with Autopsy Room 4. It was just so funny, but it wasn't supposed to be.
And that brings us to possibly the more bizarre story of the group. And, you know, this story was a fun one to read simply because anyone who has seen Maximum Overdrive knows that King has this love for rock and roll music. And, you know, they got a hell of a band. It's just kind of this story where, hey, I want to tell you about some of my favorite singers. And this is what it would be like if they were living on in this random town called Rock and Roll Heaven. And all I have in my notes for this is Love a Good Mustang.
Love a Good Mustang.
I feel bad that it traveled down that road and hit that pothole.
Oof.
But boy, oof, was it, yeah, pretty.
Yeah. This to me was like the absolute call out to people who have an aesthetic without actually having anything at the center. And I was like, yeah, tell them they suck, Stephen. I think clearly the husband is supposed to be like, he's garbage. And you're supposed to be like, this man is garbage. This man is absolute garbage.
Played by Stephen Weber, who was, yes, Jack Torrance in McGarris's adaptation of The Shining.
Yeah. I'm not anti that at all. I love the little, like, clearly, like, you know, crossovers and actors and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember reading this story, so I was wildly confused by the episode, and I think for me, that ultimately makes it not as successful. Every other episode, even if I didn't remember the story, I was like, oh, I can follow what's going on. But with this one, I was like, what? I don't get it. Okay, the wife's a psychic. That's just done. Like, we know that. But, like, did they die in the beginning? They, like, almost get hit by a truck and they swerve away. But, like, it felt like everything that came after that moment was, like, a fever dream. So I was like, oh, are they dead?
Yeah, because it's like the radio sparks or something too in the car, and he starts to veer onto the wrong side of the road, and he quickly turns the wheel and
they just miss this truck.
You get a feeling that as hard as he turned that wheel, that car would have been flipping.
Oh, absolutely. That thing doesn't have power steering.
No.
That's not how that works. Nor power brakes. Yeah, because after that, everything that happens is supernatural as heck.
Yeah.
But in no discernible, like it's all like a lot of it is hinting until you get to the scene in the diner later, the second diner in Rock and Roll Heaven. But you're just like, no, they died, right? Like the weird rollerblading teens. Sorry. I can't say that in a straight face. I was just like, push them over. They're on rollerblades. What are they going to do? They can't even jump off. It's not like a skateboard. Rollerblading hooligans. Like, it seemed like they were it seemed like they went to hell after getting hit by that car. Right? Am I crazy? Everything, like.
It's very hard because this story, I don't think, makes it very clear either. This one is one from Nightmares and Dreamscapes itself, but I don't think it's a super long story, and I kind of just remember it being like, oh, by the end of it, they definitely seem dead because everyone in the town seems dead and they've lost all sense of time. You know, there's the woman from the diner, and when they go to attend the concert, they ask her, oh, how long have you been here? And she's like, I don't really know.
Yeah.
A few years.
It's so weird to me. It also like...
And he's just so into it too. Like,
yes,
it does not dawn on him. And then he's clapping at the concert, even after all of this stuff has happened. I will give them credit though. They did a very nice job with the lookalikes, basically.
Yo, everyone but Jimi Hendrix to me was like pretty on point.
But Hendrix, all you had to see was the upside down guitar. And you were like, yes, we know.
I almost wish they hadn't showed him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But to me, I was just like, all right, I kept trying to guess what was going to, not what was going to happen, but what was happening. I was like, all right, is it this? And they get to the second diner where like the rock stars are also working in a diner. This town seems awful for the rock stars as well. They have to get like regular ass jobs. Janis Joplin is your like waitress. I'm like, you're Janis Joplin. And the pie seemed so important. But it never actually gets stated that that's why they get stuck there. And I wish that it had. Because it seemed very much like a setup. Like, all right, if they're not already dead, if they have a chance of leaving, which it seemed like they did from the napkin, then it should be like, oh, but you ate the food from here and now you have to stay. Right? Because they seem to get away until the wife licks the cherry pie or elbow.
Yeah.
And then it's like, nope, like the bus is in front of them and they like whatever. And I was like, is it the food? Is that why they couldn't leave? Like, because that feels like an underworld story very much to me, like very Greek, right? I don't know, man. This one had a lot of cool stuff in it, and I had no idea what was going on the whole time. I was just like, all right.
Janis Joplin. This was one where it's like, here, enjoy the visuals. Don't pay attention to the story.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like you said, they did a great job with the lookalikes. The Elvis one was great. I didn't understand a lot of the horror imagery that was happening. So, like his lack of eyes, Janis Joplin vomiting maggots,
yeah.
But for no reason, I was like, shouldn't she, like, it should just be regular. Like, if it's how they died, like, that would be interesting or, like, related to that. There's, like, that nightmare the wife has about the diner they just came from, and there's, like, a finger floating in the, I was just like, but what does it all mean, Stephen? I was a little tight too with the main character. This is when I decided he was a bad guy, which was literally at the beginning of the story where he's basically like shits on disco. He's like, oh, that's when music died, is when they dreamed up disco. And I was like, oh, so black people music is not what you're into, except rock and roll is black people music.
Yes.
But the black people music that was undeniably black, that literally people started burning the discs because they didn't want black people to have none. Okay, cool, 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 cool. You're a jerk. Yeah. Okay, I hope you get Stephen King too.
And then he gets you know, kind of pulled over by Otis Redding there. And I was like, this is what you get.
That was so funny.
This is what you get.
That was funny. I was like, all right. All right, I would do that. I wish that the wife had gotten away, not just because I liked her character, but because it seemed like she was trying to save him from himself the whole time. And I just find it a little too tragic that she had to suffer because this man wouldn't listen. It's like, no,
it's
she
fine.
Like,
this dirt road that
up.
Is definitely not two lanes. We're good.
Oh my God. I was like, girl, divorce. Time to get a divorce. Just, you know, I just want to get one t-shirt. I'm like, leave. She could have made it. I firmly believe, even though there's nothing to support this except for my own nonsense, that if she hadn't licked the cherry pie filling off her arm, she could have made it.
She should have been like, give me the keys. I left my purse in the car and just took off after that.
No, he left her there to die. That's right. I hate this dude. He's terrible. Oh my God. That's right. Ugh. That's right. She was trying to get him out. And when he finally gets it, he's like, yo, I'm just going to go to bye. I was like, yo, your wife.
Yeah, she should have been like, give me the keys. I need to go get my purse. And then just left him there.
Oh my God. Absolutely. 100%. Oh, man, that guy got what he deserved. But I think she deserved better.
I think she did make it to the car, though. But he was like in there ready to go and was like, hurry up.
He was waiting on her like, oh. And I'm like, yo, she had to fight off Buddy Holly's ghost.
And maggots.
The blood thing I thought was really effective of his like just bleeding from the eye and then wiping it away. I was like, oh, that's creepy. I almost wish there was like a smear of blood left on his face because the veneer is like gone. They should have all looked like super dead. That would have actually been really cool.
Or like he wipes it and like part of the makeup comes off or something.
Oh, yeah. Something like that. Like that's real solid. Just make him more zombie-like. Oh, man. The whole time I just kept yelling at him.
It was an interesting note to end on. That's for sure.
It is. You're just like, that's confusing. Was it supposed, it was a limited series event or was it supposed to be?
I don't know if it was supposed to be more seasons and they just didn't get renewed, but they definitely wanted it to be like the Twilight Zone-esque, like I mentioned at the top of the episode. And it's hard to tell because so many of his things were miniseries around this time still.
Yeah, like The Stand and all that kind of stuff. No, that was before. That was in the...
Stand was like 94, I want to say, but yeah. Salem's Lot was like 2 years before this, and it was like a 3-hour thing, and I think they maybe wanted to do more with this, but this is an odd group of episodes for sure.
I feel like if that was the case, then I feel like the thing that it was missing that the Twilight Zone and shows like the Twilight Zone, like The Outer Limits kind of have, is that each episode has a point, like there's a metaphor that they're pushing or a lesson that you're supposed to learn. And with these, like for a couple of them, I was like, oh, like I clearly see where you're going and it's based off of his story anyway. So like, I clearly, that was the metaphor of the story. But for a few of them, I was just like, I don't understand why I'm what? Like, I don't understand why I'm seeing the images that I'm seeing.
What a ride this was.
Yeah. I mean, you know, shotgunned it 3 days.
Yeah. Same.
I'm going to go back and watch some of the stuff from Battleground and probably Crouch End if they have anything about that too.
Yeah, they do interviews with a lot of the cast members, at least like the main one or two from I think almost each one, because each disc had its own bonus features. And I think I only went through disc one maybe for, you know, time purposes. I was like, you know what, I'll look into at least Battleground because that one I want to know how they did it. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Okay, so blue screen, real people as the soldiers, that's cool. But yeah, this was definitely quite the ride. And Vita, thank you for going on it with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, as always. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Same to you. And I'm sure I will at least be texting you about more King stuff, and you're going to come back for a bonus episode. So if anyone wants to check out the bonus episodes, be sure you're a Patreon supporter because that's where all of the comic book episodes are going.
I'm waiting for my copy of the comic to come in.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.